All right, welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education on the New Books Network. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and I'm excited today to bring you a book that I think is quite relevant to our current state of political affairs and education. And this is the book, it's called The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education. And this is a critical social thought series from Routledge, and it was published in late 2014. And the authors are Diane Hess and Paula McAvoy. And today I'm proud that we have Dr. Hess from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Education on the show. Dr. Hess, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Ryan.
And just if you can maybe give me a brief background about yourself, how did you get into education? I understand you were a teacher before. Can you kind of maybe let us know your academic and educational background, if you would?
Sure. I was a high school teacher outside of Chicago for a number of years, and I was also president of the local teachers union. And after doing that for many years, teaching social studies, primarily political science and law classes, I went to work for a nonprofit organization called the Constitutional Rights Foundation Chicago, which develops materials and leads professional development programs for teachers who are interested in learning how to teach about political and constitutional and legal issues. I went to the University of Washington in Seattle to study with Dr. Walter Parker and did my PhD in curriculum and instruction with a specialty in the law school, and then went to the University of Wisconsin in 1999 in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. And while there, I continued my interest in teaching and learning about controversial issues and did a number of studies, including a large longitudinal study that resulted in the book, The Political Classroom.
Okay, fantastic. Can you kind of tell me and tell our audience a little bit about that longitudinal study? And I think you have some mixed methods involved in there. Can you kind of just let everybody know what that entailed?
Sure. The longitudinal study started in 2005, and I was interested in learning about how students experience a particular kind of civic education, which is a focus on discussing highly controversial political issues. And so I sought out schools initially in two states, Illinois and Indiana, where teachers were using this kind of approach to civic education, and matched them with similar classes in their schools that did not use that approach, and spent a number of years collecting both quantitative and qualitative data, trying to understand what was happening in these classes, how teachers were approaching it, and then followed the students 2 and 4 years out after high school. So it's an unusual study in the field of social studies and specifically in civic education, because there's really rich qualitative data from when the students were in high school, but also very extensive data from hundreds and hundreds of kids 2 and 4 years out after high school.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, just the sheer sort of logistics of keeping track and I guess showing up when you did. How did that work? If I can ask.
Well, it worked with the help of people like you, Ryan, lots of graduate students who were traveling throughout Illinois and Indiana, and then eventually we added the state of Wisconsin. So we'd have lots of people on the road, observing in classes and interviewing students and interviewing teachers. I was, in the schools myself a lot, and it was really kind of a interesting challenge, I think, in terms of just the logistics, as you would suggest. I mean, it was, for me, quite a very large study, but it was also really fun because we were in the classrooms of a number of really extraordinary teachers. So one of the things that I learned from the study, and the co-author of the book, The Political Classroom, Paula McAvoy, also learned, and she was in a lot of the classrooms, is that teachers really, really matter. I mean, this shouldn't be a surprise to any of us, but we saw just extraordinary teachers who were very, very skillful, very reflective about their own practice. And so we came away from the study with, I think, better understanding of what teachers do who are exceptionally good at this form of civic education.
Sure. Can you maybe go into that a little bit, that idea of civics education? I think you call it or I guess you dub it the political classroom. Can you maybe talk about what that is a little bit more and maybe how that's different from potentially a normal classroom?
Right. Well, so civic education is typically defined as a type of education designed to prepare people to participate politically and civically. Often it's called democratic education when you're talking about preparing people to participate in a democratic political structure. In our book, The Political Classroom, we focus on a particular type of civic education that revolves around helping young people understand the contemporary and highly controversial political issues of the day. It's not the only thing that happens in these classes, but it's a major thing. And the theory behind this form of civic education is that what we want is for young people to understand, to appreciate, to be informed about, to form opinions about the actual political decisions that they're going to need to make as participants in a democratic society. And so the best way to do that is to make sure they've got a lot of complex understanding of how the government works and doesn't, as the case may be, but that they also are really deeply embedded in and interested and engaged in actual political issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. How diverse was your sample? Did you have a lot of socioeconomic, regional within maybe city areas or race as well? Can you kind of talk about that?
Right. So the sample, as I mentioned, was in three states: Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. And those three states in 2005 were quite different from one another politically. Wisconsin at the time was what we would call a quintessential purple state, beginning to become highly polarized. Today, it's probably the most polarized state in the United States. Illinois was a bluer state. Indiana was a redder state. And that really mattered quite a bit because one of the things we were interested in was ideological diversity, both within the communities in which these schools were housed, within the schools, within the classrooms, and among and between the students. So the kind of diversity that this study focuses on is one that typically isn't given very much attention in research and education, which is ideological or political diversity. That being said, we had quite a diverse sample. We had schools that were public schools and private schools within the public school sector. We had charters and schools that were not charters. We had religious schools and other private schools that were not religious schools. We had schools in cities and suburbs and rural areas. So we think we had a pretty good mix of schools. And our student sample roughly mirrored the state in which they were embedded. Mm-hmm. So we had lots of kids who were of different race, of different social class in particular. You know, at a time, in a time of growing economic inequality, the social class of students matters in a lot of ways. We've known this for a long time. What we sought to do in this study was to get a better understanding of how social class matters in terms of preparation for political and civic engagement. Mm. So having that diversity of social class was really important.
Right, right. I think you hit it on the head when you talked about the sort of growing political partisanship or polarity. And it just seems more difficult than ever. And I can't imagine, I'm not in a classroom myself, not high school or I teach some undergrads, but much different than I think in a public school setting, especially teaching when they haven't really gotten this kind of civics before, they're getting it for the first time. To really go out and teach politics without having some sort of your own a bias in the teaching. Can you maybe talk about how you sort of gauge that idea of sort of how you can play both sides or teach both sides of the arguments?
One of the things that we did in the book was to focus on the ethical questions that teachers who are approaching civic education in this way need to deal with. And one of those ethical questions is what role their own political views should play in their teaching. And we concretized this with the question, should teachers share or withhold their own political views during discussions of these controversial political issues? And what we found, not surprisingly, is that there's a lot of difference among how teachers approach this. We had teachers in the sample who were absolutely resolute about never sharing their political views with students, and their students didn't think that they knew their political views. We had other teachers who said, oh, I never share my views, but their students thought they knew their views. And in some cases, we had classes in which half the teachers or half the students said, we know, and the other half said, we didn't know. And of those who said they knew, half thought the teacher was conservative and half thought the teachers were liberal. So this became a much more complicated question than I think people previously had understood it to be. But that being said, what we did come away with is that that question, the question of whether teachers should share or withhold their political views, is not a question for which there are firm and clear rules, but in fact is a question that requires professional judgment. We were in classrooms where teachers did share their views, and we thought that was done in ways that were really pedagogically quite interesting and sound. We were in other classes in which teachers did not, and we thought that worked as well. It didn't mean that anything goes, but it meant that the context in which the teachers were teaching, the composition of the students' political views, et cetera, really mattered, and teachers had to take all that into account. We didn't encounter any teachers who believed that their job was to get students to adopt their own political views. I know such teachers exist from my own experience as a high school teacher, but we don't think there are very many of them, and we didn't have any in the study. Sure. That being said, teachers are political beings, and we knew about the political views of the teachers because we surveyed the teachers using the same questions we used with the students. So we knew, for example, if we were in the third period class at Adams High School, what the students thought about particularly controversial issues, what the teacher thought about those same issues, how much variation there was, etc. So we have tremendous amount of information that helps us understand the political context in which this work was occurring.
Mm. Okay, very good. And I think you kind of already started going to, but you break the book up into three different sections. First, you kind of talk about the study, next, the cases, and then sort of the professional judgment. I wonder if we could go back to maybe talk about some of the cases that you have in the book, and you mentioned Adams High. Can you kind of talk about why that case was special or what's sort of interesting about that case for the book purposes?
Sure. Adams High is a high school in a working class community about 40 miles outside of a large city. It's a racially and ethnically diverse school. About 40% of the students are Latino. It's got a tremendous class diversity, which, as you know, is quite unusual because most schools, high schools especially, are highly segregated by race and class, and this one was not. The teachers at Adams High had invented a form of civic education about 20 years ago that they called the legislative semester. Mm-hmm. Students were required to take a one-semester government class as seniors. That class was not tracked. There was no AP section or no honors section, and there would be several hundred students a semester taking the class. There were a number of different teachers teaching it, and the students formed a legislature where they worked across the various sections of the class during a semester to operate as a legislature. The students developed bills, they had committee meetings, they had full sessions of the legislature, they appointed leadership, elected leadership, etc. It's really a phenomenally interesting approach. Quite an elaborate simulation that students absolutely loved it. I mean, it was one of the most exciting things I've ever seen. And it required an enormous amount of cooperation among these teachers. You know, oftentimes we have a vision of a highly successful teacher as a lone wolf, you know, someone who gets behind his or her classroom door and kind of does what he or she thinks is the best thing to do. That was not the case at Adams High. At Adams High, these teachers work collaboratively year after year after year to refine this particular approach, to adjust it as they needed to, as their student population changed and as the political issues of the day changed. And it's now spread to a number of other schools. We think there are about 20 schools in the Midwest that have adopted this particular form of civic education. So we had a blast at Adams High.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I'm just thinking these critical thought exercises that last a whole semester or a year, however long, And I'm thinking my state in Oklahoma, what's going on right now. I'm just like, oh, I wish we could, you know, maybe get some of that, get that there. How about with these other two cases you introduced two teachers, Mr. Kushner and then Mr. Walters. Can you kind of talk about what made these two teachers special?
Sure. Mr. Walters teaches in an evangelical Christian high school. It's very small, in outside of a university community. Teachers who teach at this school, including Mr. Walters, are very religious, as you would imagine. And the students and their parents need to sign a contract saying that they've been personally saved in order to get into the school. Oh, yeah. So it's not just a typical religious school, but it's quite a religious school, yeah. Let's put it that way. Mr. Walters was an extraordinary social studies teacher who was interested in making sure that his students, who were raised in a very politically homogenous environment, were exposed to points of view that were different than what they typically encountered, while not upsetting their faith. So he was walking this kind of interesting line between, on the one hand, wanting to build a political autonomy, on the other hand, wanting to make sure that he was doing his job as a teacher in an evangelical Christian school of building more understanding of and respect for the students' religious views. So we included a whole chapter on Mr. Walters in the book because we thought he did really an interesting job of walking that line. And we were also interested in, you know, what it looks like to, on the one hand, approach civic education from kind of a liberal democratic theory, which is that you've got multiple and competing points of view, that you want people to come to their own views, and yet on the other hand, to be embedded in this highly religious environment in which parents and teachers are very interested in making sure that students adopt the views of the faith.
Yeah, the degree of difficulty for that, I think, is much harder maybe than even just your normal public school, especially to do it, you know, really, really nicely and bring in all the different ideas. So that's really great. How about Mr. Walters? What does he have for this book?
Well, so Mr. Walters, again, who's the teacher in the religious school, is really an interesting guy because he wanted his students to be exposed to differing points of view. Now, Mr. Kushner...
Mr. Kushner.
No, that's okay. Mr. Kushner... in some ways taught in a school that on its face looks remarkably different, in fact, the opposite of Mr. Walters' school, but was actually quite similar in some key ways. So Mr. Walters taught in a public high school in a university community, one of the most progressive, politically progressive communities in the United States. There were three precincts that fed into this high school, and those three precincts were among the... precincts in 2008 and 2012 that had the largest majorities for Barack Obama. Very, very left-wing precincts, very left-wing parents, very left-wing kids. And so Mr. Kushner was trying to make sure that his kids were also exposed to multiple and competing views. So one thing that really surprised us is here are these two schools, a really religious school and then a traditional public school. You would think they would be so different from one another, and yet Mr. Walters and Mr. Kushner had a similar challenge, which was these kids were being raised in very homogenous political communities. They were kind of marinating in their own ideological stew, so to speak, and we ended up calling these schools like-minded schools, which meant that in the classes, when we polled the students on their views on political issues, 70% or more of the students had the same views. And so these like-minded schools and like-minded classrooms were interesting places. They presented some opportunities, and they also presented challenges. So what we know politically is that if you live in a politically like-minded environment, for example, where I live in Chicago is a very politically homogenous environment, you're much more likely to be politically active. So the people who are politically active are surrounded by other people who are politically active and are surrounded by other people who have the same political views. So like-mindedness causes political participation. And that is both a good thing because we want people to politically participate and a challenge, right? Because if you're in these like-minded communities, what you're not hearing is views that are different from your own, which means that the views of people in these like-minded communities over time tend to become more partisan, more polarized, more extreme. Mm-hmm. This is what happened in these classrooms as well. And interestingly enough, as we report in the book, when we followed students from these classrooms 2 and 4 years out after high school, we realized that when we controlled for all sorts of other things, social class, etc., that these students were much more likely to participate in all sorts of ways, especially as voters. So we saw this phenomenon that we're seeing in society as a whole. So back to these teachers, Mr. Kushner and Mr. Walters, saw these homogenous political communities as a real problem. And they wanted to expose students to differing points of view, even though they, the teachers, had political views that were very similar to the communities that they were housed in. Mm-hmm. The religious teacher, Mr. Walters, was actually a little bit more moderate than his students. But Mr. Kushner was the most left-wing teacher in the study. So here we have these teachers who have political views that are similar to their students, similar to their parents, and yet the teachers say this would be a problem if all these students heard were these views. So they went to great lengths, which we explain in these two chapters, to make sure that students had to encounter views that were different than the majority in which they were embedded.
Okay, that's fantastic. Can you maybe talk about what were the students, if you can single that out, what were the students' sort of reaction to hearing these different sorts of views? Or were they appreciative, or did this come back in the future? Because I know you interviewed them 4 years out. Can you kind of talk about that, if you could?
Yeah, it's a great question, Ryan, because it wasn't the case that students immediately recognized that it was a good thing to hear views that were different than their own. And that's no different than the rest of us, right? Oftentimes, especially when we live in communities that are politically homogenous, it can be literally shocking to realize that it's not the case that everyone agrees with us. And that was the case for these students as well. Sometimes they would just be so surprised when they had to encounter these very, very different points of view. So, for example, Mr. Kushner had students who, for the most part, were in total agreement that abortion should be legal in the United States and that restrictions on abortion should be very minimal. He brought in a speaker who represented an organization that had very contrary views, and initially the students really didn't like it. They were offended by what the speaker had to say, not because the speaker was offensive, just because the views were so different. But when we interviewed the students 2 and 4 years out after high school, they looked back with appreciation. And they said, Mr. Kushner was one of the few teachers in that school who really cared about making sure that we had to reflect on our own views and that we had to have our own views critiqued and we had to consider the views of others. One of the students, when we interviewed him, we asked, well, what happens in other classes in the school? And the student said, well, you've got to realize that in this school, we've seen every Michael Moore film twice. And so when this student looked back, after high school, he said, look, this was really great. Because, a lot of us did leave this very homogenous community. And even if we didn't, we had an experience, having to encounter different views. Of course, that was harder to pull off in those schools than it was in these other schools that we called non-like-minded or purple schools. Mm-hmm. If you think about, purple, red, blue states.
Right.
So we talk about purple, red, blue classrooms. And in those more ideologically mixed schools, like Adams High School was one of those, teachers had a much greater challenge, which was how to keep the lid on, right? They wanted to make sure that they didn't have so much political debate that it would become not civil.
Right.
And so those teachers focused a huge amount on how do you deal with people who are different from you in ways that are respectful, in ways that are civil, whereas the teachers in Mr. Kushner and Mr. Walters' class, for the most part, had to focus on how do we insert into these homogenous environments political difference.
Right. How about, I guess the next natural question is, how about parents? Do the teachers face, I'm assuming that it's very difficult sometimes when you're teaching these things that, you know, you get phone calls from parents and opposition from local communities potentially even. Can you kind of talk about that role?
It's a really good question, especially since, Ryan, you mentioned a minute ago that you were from Oklahoma.
Right.
And for those listeners who aren't keeping up with Oklahoma political news, yesterday the Oklahoma legislature voted to ban the teaching of advanced placement U.S. history because they believe that the revised curriculum from the College Board focuses too much on what's wrong with the United States and not enough on what's right with the United States. And I think that represents the fact that, you know, social studies is one of these, and history, these are classes that are deeply embedded in the culture wars, and the culture wars have not gone away. You know, that we fight about what is in the curriculum because the curriculum of the schools is important to people. And so there, one way to look at this is to say that, well, gosh, what a pain in the neck to have all these fights about the content of the curriculum. Another way to look at it is that it reinforces that no matter how much we question whether people care about education, evidence that they do care about education is that they're willing to fight about the content of the curriculum. So I actually think that there's somewhat of a silver lining in some of these battles because it at least reinforces for us that people think that schools do matter. That being said, one of the challenges is that parents often don't want their children to hear political views that are different than their own. And so that can create a challenge in an approach to education, like in the political classroom, where by definition you want to have multiple and competing views, and you want those views to be about issues that are, you know, contemporary and really important. Sometimes teachers don't want, or parents don't want, those issues talked about in school at all.
Mm.
And other times they're happy to have those issues talked about as long as their kids are only hearing one point of view. So teachers had to engage with that problem. And that problem is getting worse, not better, because we're living in more politically polarized communities. That being said, the teachers in our study who were the most effective had remarkable luck dealing with that problem. And they did it in three ways. One is that they had the respect of parents and administrators because, quite frankly, they were really good teachers. And that they constantly reflected on their own practice, and they were really careful to make sure that they didn't make what I would call rookie mistakes when doing this kind of work. It's serious work, and you have to take it seriously. You have to look very carefully at the materials that you're having students use to prepare for discussions and for simulations. You have to be really fair-minded. And most of the teachers in our study were really fair-minded, that they were not interested in, as I said, indoctrinating students into a particular point of view. They were interested in making sure students were able to think seriously about differing points of view. So we actually had very few examples in this study of parents complaining. However, we interviewed the teachers about this, and they, all of them had some, you know, example of this. And they reported a couple things. One is that if the school administration had their backs, it really mattered. So, you know, we know that school leaders make a huge difference. And with this kind of teaching, school leaders have to understand why it's important for teachers to do this. They have to understand what it looks like when done well. They have to make sure that teachers are provided opportunities to get better at doing this, you know, that teachers go to professional development workshops, et cetera, to learn how to do it. They really have to support it. And then when parents call to complain, oftentimes the complaint initially goes to the principal. And if a principal can explain, here's why we do this in this school, and here's why we think it's important, oftentimes that would calm the parent down. Sometimes the parents just misunderstood, you know, that they heard a snippet. You know, a student would go home and say, well, you wouldn't believe what Mr. Green said in class today.
Right.
And that would cause the parent to misunderstand what, in fact, did happen. You know, that being said, again, we know that teachers do make mistakes.
Right.
And there are times when teachers across all sorts of lines, and that's really damaging because when teachers do that, it often causes administrators who are not very effective to just want to shut down the whole thing.
Sure.
And so it's not unusual to have administrators, especially inexperienced administrators, decide that the way to deal with controversy is to ban it.
Right.
Which, in fact, is highly controversial, right?
Sure. No, absolutely. So if we could, how can we support these types of classrooms? What can we do? It's a very difficult situation, I think, as everyone can recognize. Then how do we make it maybe easier, and how do we get more of these types of classrooms in our school?
It's a really great question, Ryan, and thanks for asking it, because I think that we need to focus as much as we can on what supports good practice in schools and not expect teachers to bear the brunt of this on their own. So in the final chapter of the book, Paula McAvoy and I outline a variety of things that we learned from the study really make a difference. So one is that there are civic education organizations in the United States that provide lots of support for teachers to do high-quality work. Some of these organizations are local, some of them are state organizations, a number of them operate nationally. So in our study, we have lots of teachers who are participating in a program called the Choices for the 21st Century program, which is housed at Brown University but operates nationally. And we also had a lot of teachers who were in a program called the Youth Summit program sponsored by the Constitutional Rights Foundation in Chicago. And there are lots of other organizations like this. There's one called Street Law. There's an organization here in Chicago called the Mikveh Challenge. There's Facing History in Ourselves, et cetera. There's a Constitutional Rights Foundation in Los Angeles, the Center for Education, Law, and Democracy in Denver, et cetera. So these organizations are nonprofit organizations that their mission is to help teachers do high-quality civic education. They prepare materials, they lead professional development sessions, et cetera. So what we found is that the teachers in our study who were really doing the best work had gotten a lot of professional development from these organizations. So these were teachers who were not holed up in their classrooms thinking that they could, you know, keep up with things on their own. Instead, these were teachers who got out and learned and really saw that as a primary mission of their teaching. So that's one thing. We need to support these civic education organizations. And a number of them are really struggling because we used to federally fund these organizations. And all that federal funding was cut out when earmarks were cut out a number of years ago. So these organizations have had to make a very quick transition to public funding, from public funding to private funding, which is, you know, hard to do. And so we as citizens need to be supporting these organizations. That's one thing. Parents, we talked about parents before. So I think that it's really important for parents to support teachers in doing this. And it's important not just to support, but parents need to demand. So if parents have children in schools where they're not getting high-quality civic education, they need to ask why not. And they need to demand it, because we know that civic education really makes a difference. And in some schools, it's been cut out of the curriculum, especially in middle schools, where the No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top have caused a lot of schools to narrow their curriculum. And when the curriculum gets narrowed, the first thing that goes is social studies and art and science. And then all of a sudden, you don't have students getting these rich opportunities they need to receive. So parents need to demand high quality civic education. Mm-hmm. As I said before, administrators need to support teachers, and we need to support administrators. Just like teachers need professional development, administrators need professional development. And last but not least, I want to go back to what I started with, is that teachers really, really matter. Mm-hmm. This is not cookie cutter teaching. This is not teaching that's what I call pack and play teaching, where you can just hand teachers materials and say, you know, go do this. This is the kind of teaching that demands lots and lots of support. People need to be taught how to do this. They need to continually reflect on their own teaching. They need to be provided high-quality materials. And we need to recognize that, you know, if we really care about the quality of civic education, then there's nothing more important than supporting teachers and helping them get better at their practice. And one of the things that was interesting to us is that the teachers in our study really were in it for the long haul. You know, we have a paragraph at the end of the book that talks about why we think teachers are so important that I think in many ways sums up the major finding from the study is that, you know, the teachers who are doing this high-quality work are not missionaries. They're not passing through on the way to another career. These are people who are what I call professional teachers. They've been very well educated. They are very serious about their work. But when we ask them, well, why do you do this? Not just why do you teach, which we did ask them, but why do you do this kind of teaching? Why are you trying to create these political classrooms in which students are focusing on questions related to how should we live together? And the teachers said three things. One thing they said is they really thought it was important work. It was part of the mission of why they became teachers, that they believed in democracy, that they believed in how important it was that schools should take up their historic role of preparing young people for political and civic engagement. So they had a mission. They also were intrigued by the content themselves. These were people who really knew a lot about political issues of the day. They spent a long time preparing to do this kind of work, and they spent hours every day keeping up to date. But the other thing, and the thing I liked the most, because it reminded me of why I went into education and why I'm still in education, is these teachers really had fun. Mm. You know, they were really engaged in what they did. It didn't mean that every day was fun. It didn't mean that every period was fun. It didn't mean that everything went well, and that these teachers were not Pollyannas. As a matter of fact, a number of them were activists in their schools and communities. But teachers who do this kind of work, when you create a classroom in which you're giving kids the opportunity to talk about important things that matter, you know, that's really interesting. It's cognitively interesting. It's emotionally interesting. And that adds up to engaging work. And we often had teachers come out of class and say, wow, that was really fun. And at the end of the day, if you can do high-quality work about a mission that you think is important, and you're having fun, I don't know what could be better than that.
Well, that's that was a fantastic, I think, exclamation point on sort of the book and wrapping it up. So I do appreciate that. And, you know, we do have to remember, I think a lot of people who are listening, you know, are educators in education. But that last point, I wasn't expecting, and I'm glad you said it. You know, have fun, right? This is, you know, not just about being a job. So definitely take that to heart. If you could, can you maybe talk about your next sort of project or what do you have coming up on the pipe? I know this, you know, you just basically got done with this, but as we all know, the next project is just around the corner. So what do you have for us next?
Well, thanks for asking, Ryan. So coming up next, we're going, and when I say we're, I'm talking about the co-author of the book, Paula McAvoy. Paula's an educational philosopher, and she's been at the Spencer Foundation, where I currently work, in addition to being a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's been there for a number of years, but now she's returning to UW-Madison to be the staff director of a new ethics and education center that it's actually just opening on March 1st. And in that role, she's going to be doing a lot of work to help academics and teachers and others think about ethical issues in education. And as you know, in this book, The Political Classroom, we focus a lot on these ethical issues. And so what what Paula's going to be doing from her perch at Wisconsin and what I'm going to be doing for the next year or so related to this book is to get it out in the hands of teachers. So what we're doing is we're creating materials that can be used by teachers to help them both learn how to teach this way and also to think about these ethical issues. So we are really trying to come up with ways of working very, very closely with teachers, both teachers in high schools and also teachers in higher education. So what we decided to do is instead of moving immediately on to other projects, although we both do have other projects that we're going to start working on, is to make sure that the work that was done to put together this book doesn't just end with the book. So, for example, we have a website that will be going up soon, thepoliticalclassroom.org, and that website will have all sorts of materials that can be used in workshops with teachers. So, for example, this question of, well, should I share or withhold my own political views? We think there are good ways of helping teachers think through that, and so we're working on how to do that. And we're going to be out doing, you know, a lot of direct work with teachers. Last night, Paul and I both spent a couple hours with teacher education students at DePaul University here in Chicago, and we're going to do a lot of that all over the place. So we're really looking forward to that. More concretely on the scholarly front, Paula is working on a new book having to do with ethical issues related to sex education in the United States. And I'm just starting the research that will form the corpus of another book that's called Courting Democracy. And that book will come out no time soon, I can promise you. But it will probably be out in 3 or 4 years. I'm going to do a major Delphi study that will form the empirical basis for that book. So we both have new projects that we're moving on to, but the new projects relate to a lot of the kinds of things that we are working on with the political classroom. We've done a lot of speaking about the research and about the teachers, and we've really enjoyed that. I think we've been on 35 different radio stations in the last month, from Fox News in Southern Utah to a labor channel in Ohio where the mantra was where the left is right. So we've had to experience ourselves what it looks like to encounter multiple and competing perspectives. Let's just put it at that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, those resources and the website, we'll be sure to link on our page whenever it comes up. And I hope my fellow educators back in Oklahoma maybe can have access to some of their resources that you're going to put up. Dr. Hess, I just want to thank you for coming on the podcast today, and I encourage everyone to check out The Political Classroom, Evidence and Ethics in Democratic Education from, once again, Dr. Hess and Paula McAvoy from Rutledge 2014, and we'll provide a link. And to all our listeners out there, I hope you learned something.